You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. We return to New Zealand's haunted islands as I welcome back Mark Wallbank to be our guide on this trip. On his last appearance, we focused on Auckland and the surrounding areas on the North Island, but it's the lush and laid-back South Island that awaits us today. With abandoned settlements and old mining camps, haunted hotels and pubs, as well as many a sacred Maori location, the South Island would seem to have it all. But before that, of course, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. Thank you to each and every one of you that support the show with your monthly contributions. Mysteries and Monsters is across most social media platforms. Please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube, and you can also find mysteriesandmonsters.com for episodes, news, and links. Our exclusive merchandise site is available via TeePublic, and the link for that is in the show notes too, and our intro and outro music are performed by the marvellous Weary Pines. Thank you as always to Dean Bestel for his wonderful artwork, and the show is produced by Mr. Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys. So, let's welcome Mark back for more of New Zealand's haunted locations. We head back to the hauntings of New Zealand on this episode as I welcome back Mark Wallbank. Following on from our journey around the Northern Island, we head to Te Wapu Namu, the South Island. Hotels, beaches, bridges and schools, the hauntings seem to inhabit every nook of this island paradise. Mark, I'm delighted to welcome you back to Mysteries and Monsters, sir.
Hello, Paul. Good to see you again.
Likewise, my friend. It's been nearly 18 months since we last spoke.
It has been about that, hasn't it? Yeah.
Yes.
We need to bridge that gap a bit.
Absolutely. We should make it more regular in general, but we still, you still leave comments, envious comments when you see which gigs I've been to in the locality.
I know. I'm living in the wrong country. I constantly say this. Yeah, I'm on the wrong part of the planet.
Well, the great thing about the internet these days is that at least we can kind of keep in touch wherever we are these days, where it doesn't seem to matter. So
toll free as well. Toll free. It's not $20 a minute.
not like the good old days, the telephone companies.
No, that's right.
So obviously, as I said, here we are, your latest book, Haunted South Island, focusing on some of the stranger and it would seem extremely ghostly places. Do you think it's quite surprising? I mean, most people, I think, Mark, if they know much about New Zealand, usually the two places they'll know are Auckland and Christchurch, obviously one from each island. You've probably got Wellington as well. But there's more to the South Island than Christchurch for hauntings and stuff. You've got three or four cities, large towns in that particular area that all seem to have a real history.
Oh, it's quite fascinating, and it's quite amazing, really. Once you start travelling around and talking to people, you start to get an idea of the scope of it, of the paranormal field, and the level of experiences that have been experienced and reported nationwide. It's just it makes you can actually see how large New Zealand really is on the big scheme of things when you start travelling around and talking to people. And it's just been interesting going to some of these, the major towns, the major cities, I guess like Christchurch, Dunedin, Invercargill, places like that around the South Island, where they have their iconic buildings. They do have iconic buildings where, you know, the hauntings are well known. They're all over the top 10 lists on the internet and that sort of thing. But you start talking to these locals in the smaller towns, the little rural towns that you have to drive for, you know, an hour or two along some rural, dusty, you know, country road to get to, or some windy bush road that takes you out into nowhere. And you end up in these little towns. And a lot of them might be old mining towns and that sort of thing, but they might only have a population of like 20 people. And there might be a few old houses there and maybe a corner store. And it's just so backward feeling. It feels like you've gone back in time, and you start talking to these people, and you might ask them about one specific haunting that you may have heard of in that little town, and they'll start telling you about other hauntings in that same town that you've never heard of before, and they point out other buildings, and then they'll say, have you been to this town? Have you been to this? There's another town just over the hill there. Have you been there before? Because they have a lot of stories there. So as you're traveling along, you're hearing all these new stories from people that you've just met, and it's just absolutely fascinating. You start to see how haunted New Zealand really is. When I started writing Haunted South, the Haunted South Island book, I didn't think I would get half the number of places that I have in it. It just kept growing and growing the more I traveled and the more people I talked to. It was incredible. And you put a few feelers out on social media and you start hearing even more stories. And since the book has come out, I've had so many messages and emails from either the location owners or people that live near the location or people that have been to that location and have experienced things themselves, who have passed on their stories as well, and also given me recommendations to other places that I should go and check out as well. So I've already got enough for about half of another South Island book in the works. and it was the same with the Haunted Auckland one. As soon as the Haunted Auckland one came out, I thought I'd covered everything. I thought that's pretty much it. It took me a few years to compile them all, but I thought, oh, that must be it. I've got them all. But when the book came out, I was getting messages from people saying, what about this place? What about this place? Places I'd never even thought of. I'd never thought of them because I hadn't heard any stories. But apparently there are stories. So I've already sort of started compiling stories for a second Haunted Auckland book as well. But then I've got all the people that are around the North Island where I am. I'm in the North Island. And people saying, well, what about the North Island? You've done the South Island. I'm like, yes, of course, I have to do a North Island book. So I've started work on a North Island book as well. And then hopefully then I've covered Haunted Auckland, where I live, and then I've covered the North and the South. But I just know that there will be enough, you know, to cover many more books after that when those ones are released. It's just always the way. There's just so much that you just don't know. It's incredible. And it's the same. It's the same with when I've been traveling around the UK. Traveling around the UK, the more people you talk to, the more stories you hear, and the more locations you find out about that you'd never heard of. So it's just, it's networking and just communication and talking. It's brilliant. I love it.
So, I mean, you've always lived on the North Island, Mark, I presume.
Yes. I'm an Auckland boy.
When was your first visit? Yeah. So when was your first visit to the South Island, either for pleasure or for the paranormal, Mark? How long was it till you decided to skip over the channel to get there?
It would have been Blenheim, I'd say. No. There was one about 20 years ago. I was invited to DJ down to the gig in Christchurch. And so I went down and I DJed. I was sort of a goth 80s retro new wave type DJ. I went down and played in Christchurch for one night, which was nice. But from there on, my wife's family all come from Blenheim in the South Island. So they're all buried there as well. So when her parents passed away, they were all buried down there as well. And so we popped down there, you know, every few years to sort of pay our respects and visit the graves and visit Blenheim again. And while we're down there, we decide to cover the rest of the South Island. So we usually just hire a car and drive around the rest of the South Island for a few weeks. And that's how I've been doing my books, really, is just doing it as a holiday, but also a research trip for myself. So just driving around and traveling and staying in places and soaking it all in. It's brilliant. And the further down you go, the further down the South Island, the more beautiful it is and the more like Scotland it is too, because there are a lot of Scottish down there, a lot of Scottish people down in Dunedin and down that way. So one thing I noticed when we went to Scotland was how much it looked like Dunedin. It's the landscapes through the countrysides are a lot the same, very similar. It's quite eerie. Yeah, it's beautiful.
I suppose it's one of those things sometimes you find that where people have moved to a different country and they seem to gravitate to the world somewhere that reminds them of home. And an Inden is one of those places, like you say. It is very reminiscent of driving through the beautiful Highlands of Scotland in parts.
Very much. It is, yep. Even down to the rock structures, you'll be driving along the road and some out in the country somewhere, and there'll be all these amazing rocks just piled up on the hillside. And that's something you see in Scotland a lot. It's just these sort of piles of rocks and sort of built up just naturally, I guess. But it's just something you only really see down in the South Island, which is interesting.
Hmm. So where was your first sort of investigation or the first location in the South Island that you heard about its haunted reputation, Mark? Is there one place that anybody who's into the paranormal in New Zealand knows of as the most haunted place on the South Island?
I wouldn't say it's the most haunted, but there is Larnach Castle in Dunedin, which is very iconic and popular. There are a lot of stories there. I've been there a few times and investigated and haven't really experienced too much outside of a few movements in the kitchen. You could sort of hear things rattling around in the kitchen like there's something, but it could have been rats. It could have been anything, you know.
Yes.
So there is Larnach Castle, which is New Zealand's really only castle, really. It's not like Scotland where there's a castle on every property. So there's that. Then we have the more rural ones, which are more isolated, like St. Bathans, which is a little tiny town of population of about two people. And that's in central Otago. And there's a little old, there's about four or five buildings there and an old quarry. And the main building is the pub. It's the Vulcan Hotel. And that just has about three rooms that you can rent, that you can hire for the night. Three little bedrooms, and there's the bar, and that's pretty much it. And there's nothing much there. You just basically people just pass through for a beer, and then they head off around the South Island. So it's more of a passing through area. We've stayed there a couple of times, but they have the stories of Rose. Rose was a prostitute who died there, and she has a hatred for men, is the way she was treated. So she has a very dislike for men, mainly married men as well. So of course, I had to be the guinea pig and stay there. It was good. The wife and I spent a night in the room there, and in room one, which is the allegedly haunted room. And we didn't experience. Well, we did actually experience a few things. Actually, we did both experience very broken sleep. Like we had really mixed up dreams, sort of nightmares, I guess, but just sort of really weird, crazy, disjointed dreams that didn't make any sense. And we both woke up feeling like we hadn't slept at all and just really quite crazy. It was kind of, we both experienced that. So whether that was something to do with it, we don't know. But we found that interesting that we experienced that in that one room that is meant to have all the activity. But yeah, it's an interesting place because it's so rural and isolated that you have to drive for quite a while to get to it. But yeah, there are places like that.
I was quite surprised reading the book. I mean, I'm not going to pretend I know that much about New Zealand, but I thought I was fairly well up on it. I wasn't aware of how much of a gold rush there was there in the 19th century. And you've got this incredible place that was called Canvas Town. Because of all the tents that were there. And it's one of those. Because often when we think about gold rushes around the world, Mark, obviously America and Australia are probably the two places that jump to mind straight away because of the famous ones in both countries. But obviously New Zealand had a very similar thing at the same time. And it seemed exactly the same. You had thousands of people just turning up in very rural locations that transformed them almost overnight.
That's right. I mean, basically, when the gold booms, now somebody would make a discovery, there would be a huge boom and everybody has moved to that region in the hopes of making it rich, you know, rich quick. And it would last, some of them would last like a few years, some would last just a few months, but people would just be furiously going there. Everybody would be there. There'd be this whole village would be thriving and all the little pubs and places would be doing very well and places like that. And then suddenly it would just dry up and there'd be another sort of claim somewhere else. So everybody would suddenly just uplift their camp and move to the next region. So it's quite interesting hearing about that old, the sort of the culture of the sort of the gold mining and how it used to just travel around and move from region to region as gold was found. There was quite a hysteria about it, quite a mass sort of craze, I guess. Everyone would just be manic and it would just be droves of people would just ascend on one place. Quite fascinating, really.
Yeah, and of course, as with any kind of situation where fortunes can be made and lost just by digging in the right place, you have death and murder and suspicion and theft and all sorts. Then, and obviously, mining is a very dangerous profession in that particular area. I mean, they didn't used to give a damn really about safety. You know, if they weren't sure, just chuck some dynamite down. Let's see what happens. Clearly, there's been a lot of sort of residue left of of people's passings, and because these places seem to be so frenetic for such a short period of time, it's almost like it's left an emotional imprint on the land, regardless of the fact that these people have been long gone for the, I don't know, the best part of 150 years for some of these places, Mark.
Oh, it certainly does feel like it. I mean, I've been to places that where the roads are pretty much closed off and you can't even drive a car through them to get to these little villages and towns that were set up. And most of them are overgrown by bushland and you know, they're just totally, you know, you have to dig through the forest to sort of find these old shacks and buildings. But the remains are there. And as you say, there would have been a lot of desperation. There would have been a lot of jealousy. There would be a lot of envy. There'd be a lot of pressure to find the gold. And there would be deaths and murders and a lot of sabotage as well. So yeah, there would be that negative energy that would come with it. I don't think it would all be positive and fun. I think it would be quite a horrific sort of period to be a part of. But you do feel a sense of that when you sort of find these old sheds and find these little paved road or these little gravel roads that are still existing there. And you find bits of old machinery, rusted up machinery there. And you can see it was a very productive little area, but it's all very confined and it's a tiny little space of only just, you know, an acre or two, a few acres worth of land. With all this machinery and housing and sheds and accommodations, and they're just left to rot and ruin, you know, and decay. It's a very eerie feeling to walk through, just knowing that there were probably hundreds of people in this one little tiny community.
And I suppose it is one of those places because, you know, the old adage about these ghost towns, I mean, the very name conjures up the paranormal, despite the fact that more often than not, it just simply means that these are very abandoned locations. There's a couple in the States that have been quite well known, and I know there's one or two in Australia as well, where you've just got the remnants of pubs and shower blocks and things like that that were set up, and that's essentially all that's left of these places. Is it surprising that these places are still... nature's reclaimed them, but you can still see the evidence of what went on there, Mark? Because I think sometimes when you think about New Zealand, it's not the kind of country people would imagine you would be able to find these kind of things. Whether that's because of the perception of the size of the island, or it just doesn't seem to give that impression of having that kind of lost history of that period. And yet, yeah, once you know, when you read the book, when you can look at certain urban explorers on YouTube, there's absolutely tons of these locations just been reclaimed by the land.
And a lot of it you can't get to because the main roads that led to these little towns are now sealed off. So you'll have these big winding roads that will follow the coastlines around the forest area around the coast, the real rural, so the real overgrown wild coastlines that we have here. So you'll follow these roads through the forests, and then suddenly you'll just spot a little bit of gravel on the side there, and that's a little indication there that there was a road there. So a lot of tourists would just, they'd miss it. You wouldn't know it was there. And just through the overgrown little pathway, you go through there, and there's like another whole road which leads to a little village. And it's completely overgrown. Most people that drive around those windy roads would just go straight past it. You wouldn't see it. But there was a road there at one point. And there are so many of those. Once you start doing the research and digging into it, you start finding where these roads were. So you can sort of plan ahead for them. And a lot of them aren't even on maps anymore. They're just, they weren't official roads. They were just sort of like, okay, we need to get down to this area where that the gold vein is. We need to get down there, so we're going to build a road. So they just gouge a track down through the canyon to get down to that area so they could dig for gold. And of course, when the gold mining finished, everybody left, and that road just sort of closes in on itself with the forest. It just sort of grows over it, and you don't see it anymore. But the main road to get to that road still exists. So yeah, a lot of people just don't know about them because you just, unless you knew about the history of the land and what was actually originally down there in that region, you wouldn't know about it. And I didn't know about it until I started digging and talking to people as well.
Yeah. I suppose the obvious thing is I know there are a couple of locations that you mention in the book where there seems to be the ghosts of miners, because there's one particular hotel where people will often claim to hear the sound of heavy footsteps being recorded, and other people have said it sounds like they can hear two men having a rather heated conversation in the early hours of the morning. And straight away people just say, well, this was a hotel used by miners and it's near that particular location.
Yeah. I guess it depends on, you know, what you feel about is real or not. I mean, if residual hauntings are a real thing, then possibly that's what that is. Maybe the building can record moments in time somehow that we just don't understand yet. Maybe it is possible. I mean, I don't know, but I mean, yeah, it just sort of feels to me like, I've been into areas myself where you can actually hear sounds that do sound like voices. I've been into places that you do hear what sounds like movement, like there's somebody moving around, but there's nobody in the room with you. So whether that's some sort of residual leftover from the old times, I don't really know. But it's just you do pick up on these things and you do sort of get that feeling that there is still something remaining, whether it's just like an imprint somehow on the building that's just there that replays itself. I don't know, but to me personally, it feels like it. It kind of, I know it doesn't mean anything in the scientific world, but it does kind of feel like there's something that is still there from those times, something residual that does hang around. Yeah.
Well, I mean, you mentioned it in the book about the Stone Tape theory, regardless of what people may think about that. It is very odd how it just seems to capture certain moments in time that aren't particularly, you know, somebody walking about is not something you would say would have a real emotional resonance. And so you begin to scratch your head and think, well, why is that being recorded? What is it about that seems to have hung around for so long? Because you can understand perhaps an argument or people screaming, or as you were saying about the Rose the prostitute in regards to how she passed away and the way she was treated in life, unfortunately. You know, there's emotional power there. Somebody walking to bed, you were like, why would this happen? Yeah. But then I suppose there are no rules, are there, Mark?
That's right. I mean, that's what I've always thought myself, actually, about the Stone Tape theory and the whole residual hauntings thing, is that it's always very random. It's never a sort of a scripted or planned event. It's never a moment in time that has been planned out, and it's almost like an act, like a scene in a movie. It's nothing. It's never like that. It's always just something that happened to be caught in that spur of the moment. Somebody walking up the stairs, somebody walking down the road, somebody. You never get a full conversation. You always just get a snippet of a conversation. It's almost like the recording starts halfway through. So it's never anything important. It's just some sort of random snippet. So I mean, the whole residual Stone Tape theory. I mean, you know, if it is possible, well, it kind of makes sense that it would just start recording at a certain any moment, just randomly. It wouldn't be a planned, scripted act, scene, start now sort of moment. It just seems like a snippet that's just randomly being captured somehow. How, I don't know.
Yeah.
Again, it just feels like it to me.
One of the strangest locations that sticks out for me in the book, primarily because of the kind of warm-up to an appearance or something occurring, is at the Cardrona Hotel in Wanaka, which seems to have this legendary former owner called Jimmy. And I've never heard of a ghost's arrival being sort of announced by the movement of a pair of skis. The locals and the regulars seem to think if the skis start moving, Jimmy's on his way.
That's right. I've seen the skis. They're sort of mounted up in the ceiling. They're just sort of hung by a couple of ropes. I mean, you could get drafts coming through the building. I mean, that's the first thing I thought of when I walked into the room with the manager there. But yeah, James Patterson, that was the Jimmy, and he'd been there for many years, and he was a well-loved hotelier there from 1926. He owned the hotel. So yeah, there's a photograph of him, you know, on the counter there, and he's meant to be keeping an eye on things. And a lot of people claim that they'll walk into their room and the bed's been messed up, and even the people that work there, they'll go and clean up a room, they'll tidy the bed, they'll do everything. They'll go back there to that room and things have been moved around and the bed's all messed up again, and yet the rooms are locked behind them. So it's like nobody goes in there. So unless there's something like a rat or something else that made its home there, who knows?
But he seems quite pleasant as well. He seems to be one of those ghosts that people are quite happy to have. I mean, there was one guy who said it felt like he was sat on the end of the bed tying his shoes.
That's right. That's right. He, I mean, from what I hear, he's quite welcoming, and people aren't really scared of him. He's he seems to be one of these just sort of nice old men that sort of just seems very pleasant to be around, and everybody sort of liked him. And there's always that sort of sense or feeling of that surrounds old Jimmy that puts people to ease. Like they never feel scared or terrified whenever they feel it. They go, "Oh, yeah, it's just Jimmy. Jimmy's here." You know, it's one of the family, which is nice. And a lot of those rural towns that you pass through down the South Island, especially in the pub, the sort of this with the whole pub culture and the drinking, and you have all the regulars that have been there for many, many years, and they just speak fondly of these people that have passed away, you know. And a lot of them, I think mainly it's just they're holding their memory, so they believe that, you know, a certain person, you know, is still there because that's where he was every day. And so they hold on to that, and it manifests into something a bit more physical to them, I guess. But for those that say that they see him, you know, maybe they are. You know, I think that's really nice. I think when a person loves a certain location and frequents it so often that that's their place, that's where they're comfortable, that's where they feel welcomed and feel like they've got family. Why wouldn't you? Why wouldn't you go back there if you could? You know, I've heard from a lot of prison people, people that work in the prisons, that say that they believe that a lot of the prisoners that have passed away come back to prison because that's where their family was and that's where their brothers and sisters were, and, you know, and that's where they felt the most welcome and that's where they felt the most happiest was when they were in prison with their loved ones, with what they considered their loved ones and their friends and their good, loyal mates.
Yeah.
And so they go back there. And so a lot of prisons are haunted by people that have been maybe set free. They've done their time, they've gone, and then they've died, but they've gone back to prison, or they've maybe died in prison and just hung around. So if in death, if we are able to leave and go wherever we want to, you'd only go back to prison if you were the most comfortable there, wouldn't you? If it was a place that you loved. So, I don't know. It makes sense in some way.
Yeah, of course it does. Well, I think it does, because sometimes when you're in that kind of situation, you're living a very chaotic life, I think, sometimes, Mark, and you're living day to day. And as strange as it may sound, and, you know, I completely understand what you're coming from here, having worked in the rehabilitation of offenders, there is this kind of community that springs up for people who get custodial sentences. And for some of them, often it's the first time they've had something consistent in their life, that they've got a routine, they've got regularity, they've got contact with people, whereas previously they could be ducking and diving and moving around all the time. They might have had a really chaotic upbringing. It, for some people, it settles them down and does what it's supposed to do. It helps them, calms them down, gives them the sort of clarification of what they need to do in their life, and they can move on. But they've still got that emotional attachment to that period of their life, because it, for some of them, it changes it for the positive, and therefore, as daft as it may sound, it's prison, but for them, it's probably the first time they had that family unit.
I agree. Yeah, it's sad, but yeah, for some it's true, isn't it?
I mean, one of the other fabulous locations is this wonderful part towards the south of the island where you've got this Maori portal where it's believed that this is the part of the island where you cross from the living to the other side, Mark. It seems, I mean, New Zealand has some breathtaking locations and vistas all over both islands, and even some of the wonderfully bleak little islands off it. I mean, one of my favourites is it Disappointment Island, which I think is one of the best named islands in the world. Which is one of those things where you think, well, you know, it's a bit of a strange name, because obviously it's remarkable because apparently most of the albatrosses in the world live there, which is one of those weird things where you're like, hang on, pardon?
It's not that bad, is it?
No, exactly. I think there was a bird that was supposed to be thought for extinct for decades that they found in the 60s there, just living happily with the albatrosses, which is also quite remarkable. But you've got some of these Maori locations, and this is a prime example of this, that it's such a breathtaking part of the country as well, that you can understand why a culture would view that place as being so special, because it looks absolutely beautiful, regardless of its alleged paranormal portal.
Oh, it is. And when you take, like myself, if I travel from, say, Auckland, where it's all built up and it's all just apartments and you know, it's very industrialized, or it's all gentrified and it's all just, you know, it's all built up. It's all concrete and steel now. There's no, hardly any countryside there. There's no trees and, you know, grass and bushland now. You've got to go out of Auckland to sort of experience that now. So for a person like myself living in these kind of environments, heading down the South Island and then being exposed to all that, it is like traveling overseas. I mean, as I was saying before, I mean, traveling down the South Island, the further you go down, the more it becomes more like Scotland. And so the more rural areas of the UK, it's very beautiful. It's very untouched. It's very old as well. It hasn't been built up and modernized. And you go into certain old buildings and they've still got old appliances and old, you know, there's still old cars rumbling down the streets, you know, just really old style cars. It just hasn't been modernized with all this technology that kind of ruins the aesthetic of a town. It's just like stepping into a bit of a time capsule and yeah, going back to the good old days, I guess, where things are a bit more simpler and people are more friendlier too. I've noticed the further down the South Island you go, they're so much more friendly. They're more relaxed. I guess there's less tension down there, but it's just nice going into like a corner shop to buy a drink or something like that. And there'll be some little old lady, you know, behind the counter, and she's lived there for many, many years, you know, 50 years or something like that, you know, and, you know, she'll, how are you going? How's it going? And she'll be actually wanting to have a conversation with you and chat. And you know, once she hears the accent or whatever, she'll, you know, they know when you're not from there. When you go down the South Island, they all speak differently. It's quite amazing. It's quite weird. It's down the South Island, they all speak differently from us here up here in Auckland. So it is a lot like going to a different country with a different culture. It's the people are different. There's a lot less stress, so people are friendlier and more welcoming. And you can sit there and you can chat with some petrol pump attendant at a service station, and he'll sit and he'll chat with you. Whereas in Auckland, they won't even talk to you. You know, you might get a grunt you'll get a grunt. You know, you won't get a thank you or hello, welcome, and how are you? And you know, they don't care. But down there, it's it's a bit slower in the pace, I guess. So it's they're a lot more interested. Yeah. It's really nice. Mm. If you haven't done it before, I would totally recommend it.
Yeah.
If you come to New Zealand, go down the South Island and go as far down as you can afford to go. I recommend it. Beautiful.
Yeah, yeah. One of the things that made me raise my eyebrows, Mark, was this story about this haunted mirror you inherited from someone. But once again, as we were talking about Jimmy looking after his bar still, this seems another quite a friendly haunting ghost, whatever you want to consider it to be, because it just seems like somebody just wanted to keep an eye on her beloved daughter more than anything else. It doesn't seem particularly frightening, but it's an odd thing to get your hands on, I suppose.
Yeah, well, we've had a few items that have been given to us from down the South Island. We picked up one a few years back. This woman and it was Dunedin, and she had one of those crying boy paintings, and her mother and father had passed away. Her mother and father died actually within like months of getting the painting. They put it up, and all the family got the skin rash, like eczema. They all got the skin rash, and she just thought that it was the painting. There's something about that painting, and the parents got really sick. Her father passed away, and then a few months later, the mother passed away unusually, and the whole family sort of came in, and that was the whole family started. There was this whole negativity and darkness that sort of swamped the whole family, and everyone was arguing, and the family sort of split up and was fighting to, you know, who got the house, who got this, and it was all very greedy and it was quite nasty. So we ended up traveling down to Dunedin to take the painting for her and a few other items that had, there was a whole scenario behind it. It was, the painting, as soon as the painting was put on that same night, when it was put on the wall, a clock apparently flew off the wall and smashed a couple of other things. It smashed a couple of things on the way and then landed on the bed, which was halfway across the room. And there was this old little cat. It was like a stuffed cat. It was just like you see them in sort of Asian stores. They could look quite realistic. They're like little furry cats, kittens and cats, and they're made out of I don't know if it's synthetic fur, but it kind of looks real. And they have these little inflatable things and the little pumps inside where you can wind them up, and they purr, and their stomachs rise and fall. It's like they're breathing, so they're sleeping. They're quite creepy, I guess.
Yeah.
the mother had one of those, and it hadn't worked for about 20 years. It never worked at all. It was broken, never worked. The clock flew across the room, smashed into the cat, who started purring and breathing for the first time in 20 years. And then the painting sort of fell off the wall and then landed down by the bed. So, of course, I had to bring back all these things with me because this girl just didn't want any of those things. She was going to throw them out. And I said, look, I'll take them. But, the mirror was an interesting one. That was one that was sent to me. That was, where was that one from? That was, I forget where that was from. It was down in South Island anyway. Is that the one with where the lady would see her mother in the mirror?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, that was an interesting one because she didn't really want to get rid of it because it reminded her of her mother, but it was just it would unnerve her quite a bit. It all started when her mother used to have the mirror beside her bed, and that's where she would sit at her bed on the side of her bed, brushing her hair and all, doing all that sort of thing. So when the mother passed away and they sold the house, the woman took the mirror and put it beside her bed. And so she could have it beside her bed, just as her mother had had in the same position the mother had had it when she was alive. She would walk past this mirror, and she would catch a glimpse, which she thought was unusual. She would catch glimpses of what she thought was her mum. And she'd have to do double takes in this mirror. Every time she passes it, she would see something in the corner of her eye. And she would do a double take. And she would think she was seeing her mum. And there was a few times where she basically sat down on the side of the bed and she looked up and she saw, it wasn't her. It wasn't her own reflection. It was her mother's reflection, but reflected in her reflection. It was kind of over the top, which sort of threw her off a few times and then unnerved her and made her panic a bit about it, whether she was losing her mind and what was going on. But there was one time where she looked into the mirror and she saw her face, but she looked older. And then she realized that the hair was different. Like she had her hair pulled up in a plait or a ponytail or something, but the image had it down the shoulders. And that's when she decided, okay, this is too weird for me. This is too weird. So she offered it to us, but on the proviso that we don't destroy it. We don't destroy it. It was just, she didn't want to destroy it. She just didn't want it in the house. So she passed it on to me to look after.
Mm.
So, yeah, I keep hoping, you know, that I'll look in the mirror and I'll see myself as a woman. Perhaps. That would be quite interesting. I don't know.
Yeah.
That would be quite interesting.
A little bit of ponytail.
Yeah. It would be a woman with a beard, of course, but, you know, it would be interesting.
Yeah.
But no such luck yet. But, yeah, it's nice. It's just nice.
Mm. Do you ever get situation like that you mentioned about the painting and the very strange sounding cat thing. Do you ever get people who want you to destroy items or like that? They just want stuff out of the house, because it is a strange thing, I think, sometimes, because obviously the crying boy is one of the most famous ones. Obviously David Clark here in Sheffield had a large collection of them, where people couldn't get rid of them fast enough, Mark.
Yeah.
Is it something that kind of thing is prevalent in New Zealand culture, that there are items that can be cursed? Because we often, sometimes you can laugh about certain objects. I remember once hearing a story about a haunted bunk bed in the States, which I literally couldn't stop laughing as I was hearing this story, because it was the strangest haunted item I'd ever heard about, a haunted bed that kept throwing the child out of it. So sometimes I think, can a bed really be haunted, Mark?
See, I'm very sceptical. I'll admit, I am very sceptical about attachments and haunted objects and things like that. But at the same turn, I just don't have the heart to say no. And when somebody approaches me and says, look, you know, I've been told that you're the person that you might be interested in this, you know, I don't want it in my house. It scares me. We want it gone. We're going to destroy it. But we thought we'd ask you if you want it first. Maybe you'd like to take it off our hands. And I just can't say no. You know, so at the moment, I don't know if I've showed you it, but I've got a whole room in this house which is just jam-packed full of junk. And that's my little archive room, and I can't even get into it. The floor, the walls, everything is just the shelves, everything is just jam-packed with boxes. And I'm looking for a space that I can make it into some sort of display museum of some description, I don't know. But there's some interesting things in there that people have given to me. And I've got Ouija boards, I've got a heap of dolls, which... admittedly, a lot of them are very creepy looking, but they were only terrifying to the people that passed them on to me, because I quite like creepy things. I like horror movies and all that. So if somebody's going to offer me a creepy doll, that's cool. But it's more about the stories. I mean, it doesn't matter whether I believe in it or not. It's more about the stories, and it's the stories that really interest me. I go to where the stories are, and my research is pretty much just based around the stories. And I follow where the stories come from, and I just take it from there. I just listen to the people that have the stories, and then I check it out for myself and go to the locations based on the stories. And that's pretty much how I operate, is just go where the stories tell me to go and just see for myself firsthand. So I end up with all these haunted objects and haunted mirrors and paintings and dolls and Ouija boards and lots of ritualistic sort of items that have been dug up or found in chimneys and little boxes that have got like bones and crystals and all sorts of stuff that were obviously for some sort of, I've got one that was meant to be some sort of reincarnation ritual. A witch friend of mine said that combination of items is usually put together for some sort of reincarnation. Somebody wants something to rebirth something. And it's thought that maybe it was somebody wanted to rebirth a pet. Maybe they wanted to live on somehow. So they bury these things with a box full of these little bits and pieces in them as part of a ritual. It's about the stories. The stories, it's the same with Ouija boards. I mean, I've got heaps of Ouija boards here that I've collected since the 80s, and I don't believe in the stories. I don't believe that things actually happen, and I've heard enough stories and I've used them enough to know that there's nothing in it. It is mind over body. And it's purely psychological, but the stories are there and the stories exist. And that's what keeps me going. That's what that drives me is the stories. The stories exist, and I'm not going to dismiss the stories. You know, the stories are worth documenting. Whether it amounts to nothing and it's just a dead end, doesn't matter. It's still a story. And I think all stories need to be told and all stories need to be documented somehow. So that's pretty much how I do it. So I ended up with a room full of rubbish that will eventually be chucked out when I die. My wife's already told me that, when I pass away, it's all going in the bin. So I've told, Sam from my team that, when I die, he's to take all of my equipment, everything, just grab it, grab as much as you can before it gets chucked. Just go for it, mate. Just go for it. Because it's going to be dumped. So I can't take it with me, and I'm not going to. So I'm just enjoying it for what it is. I enjoy looking at it and just the stories that come with them. And I like sharing the stories. A lot of people are interested in them, so I'll share the stories. I haven't got stories for all the objects. I mean, I've got so many of them, but some of them stories come with backstories. So that's nice. So I can sort of share those with people. And but I'd like to have a space that I could display them or something, or where people can actually hold them or touch them, and I don't know, it'd be nice instead of having them jammed in the box. And it's quite interesting too, because I mean, like, especially with dolls, when there's that sort of human aspect with haunted dolls, they have that human look to them. Of course they're based on humans, aren't they, people? So there's always that kind of, you do kind of make this weird attachment to dolls, where you sort of anthropomorphize them, and you're kind of, you sort of personalize them a little bit more because they look like people. So I don't know. I kind of feel a bit bad if somebody says, look, I've got this doll. Could you please take it? We don't want it in the house. And I mean, you look at the doll and you think, I've got heaps of dolls already, but yeah, okay, I'll take it. And it's almost like a foster child. You just don't feel like, you just can't say no. It feels wrong to sort of say no. No, just destroy it. Yeah, to destroy it, it's almost like you're killing something, killing a child. I'd rather just take it and sort of adopt it, really. You're kind of adopting it into this room where it stays, and it can be appreciated.
Yeah.
But it just feels wrong. It feels wrong to sort of destroy. And I've had people. I mean, a lot of people tell me that if you destroy the item, then you destroy the negative energy that comes with it. But I've also heard from other people that the energy just carries on to something else.
Yeah.
So if you destroy that item, it just moves on to something else.
Mm.
So it's never really gone. So what's the point of destroying that perfectly good Ouija board? I'd rather keep it and admire it and look after it. Yeah. So yeah.
What's the strangest item that you've been gifted then, Mark? You know, like we say, Ouija boards, dolls, trinkets. These are the usual things, aren't they? Paintings. Is there anything that you just thought, you know, like a haunted toy or something where that people have said there's something wrong with it? You know, like you were mentioning about this wind-up cat, which is quite odd. Occasionally you'll hear of very strange things. Obviously, there's a very famous story from when I was a lad growing up in the town I grew up in, Barnsley, where there was a famous story from the 60s about a dancing walking stick that used to terrorise people who couldn't believe what was happening, and people claimed that it was a hoax, that this 12-year-old kid had somehow become an incredible illusionist whilst recovering from pneumonia. I think he was bedridden, and he had this walking stick that would tap out songs to people who would come in his room.
Okay, well, that's interesting, because I've got like a little keyboard. It's a little organ keyboard. It's one of those toy ones that came out in the I think 60s, 70s. Just a little toy child's keyboard. They had built-in sounds, and you could play a little demo sound that played a little tune and stuff like this.
Yeah.
And I had this this guy that contacted me many years ago. His parents, they were quite elderly, and in the middle of the night they would wake up to the sound of this music. It was music being played, and they didn't know where it was coming from. And they tried that they would go from room to room at night, thinking, "Where's this music coming from?" And it was just like this little, really old sort of plasticky tinky toy sort of sound. You know, sort of sound of a little lullaby or a little nursery rhyme or something.
Mm.
And they would scour the house trying to find the sound, and then it would stop, and then they would lose track of it. But so every time it would happen, they would jump up and they were trying to search where it was coming from. They couldn't find it. The son-in-law came round, and he heard it. He heard like a few seconds of a little tink, 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 tink sound, and that was it. And he thought, I wonder if it's under the house. So he got on his belly and he got all muddy and whipped, you know, commando styled under the house, and crawled under the house and all that. And right in the very far corner, sort of below where the parents' bedroom was, below where their bed was, there was an old box. And it was full of old newspapers and old clothing, and there was a couple of old knickknacks and bits and pieces. But there was an old toy keyboard there, and it didn't have batteries in it. It's a battery driven thing, no batteries, and it was just the odd time it would just play. It was obviously that. So I've brought it. He offered it to me. He thought I'd be interesting. He was a follower on our page. And so he took the keyboard and gave it to us. And I sort of cleaned it up a bit and cleaned out the where the battery ports are and scraped all that and gave it a good clean and put batteries in it. And it plays perfectly fine now with batteries. But of course, it was making tunes without batteries for them. So that was interesting.
Mm.
So I've got this little organ now, which is more junk, but it's just got a neat little story that goes with it that it's quite neat. I like it.
Yeah. Has it played since you took ownership of it, Mark?
I haven't heard it playing. I mean, I've played it myself just to, you know, just to show it off, or just, I've actually used it in one of my songs. I kind of just used it in the background, just sort of played a few keys, just sort of sampled a few little sounds here and there.
Yeah.
But no, it hasn't actually. I haven't heard it going off by itself. And if it did, well, I've got batteries in it now, so it would probably be I could blame the batteries. So I should really take the batteries out.
Yes, maybe that's what's stopping it.
Yeah, so I don't know, yeah. But we've had a number of items, actually, where they're battery operated and they don't have batteries in them yet. They start playing or they start moving, like little toys that are battery operated. And you have to sort of think, well, okay, if there's no battery in it, how is that being powered? And now if the theories are true and ghosts are some sort of energy, is it their energy that's creating that connection that's making that toy move or that toy make a tune or whatever? You know, is that energy from that ghost making that connection? And we've had this similar thing with our experimenting with pop lights. We had these little mini pop lights that we bought. They're only like a dollar each. I got them from eBay, free shipping, and they were just like tiny little pop lights that you put inside shelves, inside cupboards, and you just push them and the light would go on.
Yeah.
So these sort of little tap lights, I guess. And I thought, oh, that might be a nice, cheap little trigger object to try and use. So I bought a couple of those. And we've had some interesting interactions where they seem to be, you know, turning on and on. They've got batteries in them, but they seem to turn off and on at the end of questions, when we ask questions and all that. It's almost like a response. It feels like a response. Whether it's a fault in the lamp and the lights, because they're so cheap, they're very cheaply made, we don't know. But just the timing is quite interesting sometimes. And it gets you thinking, you know, is this something, you know, something to do with the makeup of the light, or is this something that's, is there some sort of connection? Because you have to actually push the light and there's a click. You have to actually push it to turn the light on and off. And there is that click where it connects. But these lights are going off and on without the click. So something's making that connection. Something is making that connection, giving it that energy to turn on and off. So whether that's the same story with the little organ, the little the keyboard, I don't know. Whether something's just the energy is somehow getting into that machine, making that connection, which makes the sound. I don't know. Is that scientifically viable? I don't know. Or is it something that we just don't understand, that maybe it can happen, maybe it could happen, but we just don't understand how it could happen. But it's interesting. It's the whole observing and finding out. And as things happen, you sort of, you just observe and you document and you just try and do the detective work, really, and trying to figure it out as it happens.
Yeah.
That's what I love about all this.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, it's one of those things. I mean, there's another location that I found really interesting, which is this Totara River Rail Bridge, which is an abandoned bridge now, Mark. Once again, it was the proximity of a mining town that ballooned up to several thousand and then has dropped back down to a couple of hundred people now around there. But they've got this bridge that's been disused for decades that people claim...
Yep.
They see people on there wandering across certain times. And it's one of those that I think the bridge has been condemned as well now. And it's extremely dangerous. It's falling apart. Yep. It's not the kind of place. I mean, we know there are certain locations. I mean, there's been a couple of tragic stories in the States of alleged haunted railway bridges where people have been caught unawares, that they didn't realise there was a train that still ran on that track or whatever. This seems to be one of those that, even if it is somebody, you know, having some fun or just trying to wind people up, it's not the kind of place people would go to try and hoax something, because they're taking their lives in their hands.
That's right, yeah. I mean, it could have been a bridge that a lot of people just sort of traversed and just walked along to get from A to B. And again, if residual hauntings are a real thing, if the stone tape theory, maybe something about the atmosphere there recorded those actions in the bridge somehow. I mean, I don't know how that would happen, but just that moment in time just captured. It could just be simply a few people walking across the bridge one night or one day on the way home from work. Somehow it's captured. That moment was captured and it just replays itself. I don't know. I mean, it's just a bridge, an old bridge. I've only seen photographs of it, but it is just an old bridge that is decaying. But it had a use, and it would have been used for many, many years. So a lot of people would have crossed over it at some point. So I guess it's the same with every sort of residual type haunting, is that if, like theatres where hundreds and hundreds of people use it daily, and there's always still something that's sort of hanging around afterwards, some sort of vibe or atmosphere or some sort of mood or energy that sort of hangs around. When you have an accumulation of many people or many things happening in one small confined space, there seems to be something that is able to sort of just linger, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, it would be very similar. I mean, if you look at, say, Christchurch again, one of the most famous alleged haunted locations there is this place called Ballantyne's, Mark. So what is Ballantyne's, and what's some of the stories about that particular location?
Well, that was an old department store, huge old department store, multi-story. It's a massive place. And that was burned down. And most of the people got out, but I think a few people did die in the fire and the panic. But yeah, it's used for something else now. But I know, people are still hearing people in the building. But I don't think there were like a lot of deaths in that building. It was just sort of, I think most of the people got out. There are only a few sort of injuries and a small handful of deaths there. But whether that was something before, way before the fire happened, you know, something could have happened to the building before that fire, many years before, that created those ghosts. So those ghosts don't necessarily have come from the Ballantine's fire. They may have existed way before that, 100 years prior to that, perhaps even. You just don't know what was on the land, you know? Mm. You don't know what was on the land. What building, was there a building there before Ballantine's was built? You know, what happened there? I mean, many questions but to this day, there are still people experiencing things there. But whether it was, you know, from the fire, we don't know, or something before that.
Mm.
It's a huge building though. It's quite massive.
Yeah. I suppose that's the thing often when you have, I mean, this is the thing that surprised me. Sometimes you'll hear people and they'll say, well, how can my house be haunted? It's only 30 years old. I'm a big believer in if somewhere's going to be haunted, you can have haunted land. I mean, history happens, like you say. Just because your building's 30, 40, 50, 100 years old, you've no idea what was going on there 300, 400, 500 years ago. You've no idea what could have happened there. And so sometimes, because something happens, I think in the modern era, we prescribe that as being the explanation as to what was happening. And yet sometimes when you hear about these hauntings, it doesn't seem to match the history of that particular building.
Exactly. Yeah, that's right. I mean, you look at old maps and old footage, aerial footage of Auckland, for example, 100 years ago, old maps and all that, and it's all just country. It's all just farmland with little houses scattered amongst it. It's there's just nothing really there. And then you look at the sort of recent, and it's all just built up, apartments, shopping centres, and it's all completely, you know, built up. So what happened in those early houses that were existed there? They were all pulled down, they burnt down, they were all torn down to make apartments and blocks of shopping centres and motorways and all these main roads and, you know, industry and all that sort of thing. And who's to say that something tragic or significant didn't happen in those early buildings on that land before it was all torn down and rebuilt.
Mm.
I think you have to sort of dig way back, way, way back. I mean, what happened on the lands? But what about when those houses weren't there originally and it was just land? Perhaps there were Maori battles that raged across a lot of land around the country here as well. So there was a lot of bloodshed as Maori battles, you know, raged across. And it's just, I mean, today, the areas are all built up with full subdivisions and houses, and there's apartment blocks and shopping centres and movie theatres, and it's just, you know, a big hive of activity. 200 years ago, 300 years ago, 600 years ago, it was just forest, farmland. Yeah, I think you sort of got to dig right back and think, you know, what happened back here? And ghosts, I don't believe, sort of necessarily relate to the building that they're in right now. I think possibly they could relate to what the building was prior to that building being there. Maybe.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, we can't talk about South Island. I know when we spoke last time, we kind of deviated into a couple of, because you like weird things. Yes, you enjoy going investigating haunted locations and looking at certain things, but you like all kinds of strangeness, Mark. I've always thought this, ever since I first came across this particular story, this happens to be one of my favourite UFO stories ever, possibly because it's also got some of the most compelling footage, I think, that's ever been caught. And the one thing that often surprises me about New Zealand is there seems to be a real lack of UFO cases, really. I think most people would struggle to name one unless they're, you know, they're full-on strange people like we are, Mark. But the Kakura incident from 1978 has always fascinated me because of what happened and because they had such compelling evidence? Because when you see that footage, what is it?
Yeah, see, I never saw it myself. I've seen the footage and I've seen the photographs. To me, when you see that looping photograph, it looks like a big ampersand, that sort of loop that it does. That's only one frame. So if that UFO was being filmed on an old video camera or film camera back in those days, that one frame, it could have been just camera shake to make it appear like that.
Mm.
I mean that loop that it makes, that big sort of ampersand loop, looks like a musical note or something. To me, if it's only on one frame, it could just be camera shake. Because when you see the video footage of the Kaikoura UFOs, it's actually an orb, isn't it? It's a round spherical light that's moving along. It's only when the camera shakes that you see that sort of loop effect, and it's only for one frame. So I'm not too sure. I mean, I don't know what it was. There are a lot of, people say it was old boats out in the harbour. People say it was, we didn't have drones back then, so you can't blame drones. Obviously, it wasn't a helicopter.
Yeah.
You're very limited. There was Chinese lanterns were around back then, I guess, but they don't really move like that, and they don't last as long as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, you're very limited. I mean, it is a very interesting one because we didn't really have much back then that you could attribute it to, and, debunking it was a lot harder because we didn't have the things we had around today, like drones and those sorts of things that you can point the finger at.
Mm. Well, as well, I think what people sometimes forget about that is that footage was caught because something else had happened a couple of days previously. I think some pilots had said they'd been buzzed by something, hadn't they, when they were flying over there, and that's why they were actually up there. It wasn't that they just thought, oh, we'll just fly here into New Year's Eve and see what's going down. It was actually something had been reported, I think, 2 or 3 days earlier by some pilots. And then I think the other compelling thing about it is whilst this was happening, something was being registered on radar, I believe, at the same time, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, my wife's got an uncle. My wife's uncle was one of the radar operators back in the day. And even he said that he didn't see that incident, but he knew all about it, and he talked to people that were part of it all, and he said that they saw stuff themselves that they couldn't explain, and these guys are experts in their field, and they saw stuff that defied all manner of what we're able to achieve with aerodynamics and stuff like that. And he said that they saw stuff, but they were told that they weren't allowed to report them, so... Yeah, whether there were cover-ups and all that, I think so, because, when you talk to people that were actually working there, they were told that they couldn't report it, just to ignore it, just to dismiss it. Mm. So there was cover-up happening. As far as Kaikoura, it's one of those ones that we haven't really been able to explain yet, and there have been numerous documentaries and books and people that worked, that were there at the time, have come forward, and it's just been discussed heavily. And it's never really been debunked or explained. It still stands as one of the great ones, I think.
Absolutely. I've always liked it. I think it's one of those, because if you watch what happens, the incident's quite compelling, primarily because the other aspect of this is I love the chap who's the main reporter, Quentin Fogarty, because that's just a wonderful name. It just harks of adventure for some reason. I think, Mark, there's something about that name, and he's clearly very excited about what's going on. You can tell that he doesn't understand what seems to be happening.
Well, they were all seeing things that we, as viewers, didn't see.
Yeah.
We didn't. We only saw our side of it from looking at the television screen. They were there, the people on the ground with holding the video cameras and filming it and looking at it with their eyes. Yeah, they're the ones that saw the real deal. So we can only imagine what it was like. They know.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, they were there. So.
Yeah. Well, it's one of those, isn't it? Everybody goes, I'd love to experience something like that. I'm not really sure you'd like to be in a plane in the middle of the night, flying over the sea, seeing strange lights following your plane that nobody seems to understand what it is. I think that's why you can kind of understand why he was getting a bit overexcited, because I'd be bricking it, I have to say.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Well, you just have to look at the excitement on the, you know, the old Tic Tac ones, the Tic Tac pot, yeah, the Tic Tac UFOs that people, but the pilots have filmed, you know.
Yeah.
Flying at great speeds, and just the hearing the excitement on the pilots. Yeah, as they're coming through and they're narrating what's going on as it's happening, you know, as they're trying to lock on the radars and trying to follow it, you know, and they're all excited because it's something completely new, completely exciting, and they're just blown away by it, how the speed and what, you know, the movements. They just can't believe what they're seeing.
Mm.
And these guys are experienced. They're trained in their fields, and for them to be overly excited about something like that shows that there's something in it.
Mm.
It's not normal.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think the emotion is one of those things. If you're taken by surprise, you can't explain that away, because it all your senses kind of take you to a different level, I think.
Yeah, I agree.
Mm. Well, before I let you leave, Mark, last time we spoke, we were talking about a couple of regular places you go. I noticed on your YouTube channel recently, you've done another overnight at the lake house again, and you seem to have had once again some very strange things going on there. It seems to be somewhere that just consistently keeps you on your toes when you and the team go visit there
again. Yeah, it does feel like it. I mean, what intrigues me is that all the interactions that we've been having at the lake house seem to point to it being a child. There's been nothing there that sort of points to it being an adult or somebody tall. It's always been short, little shadows, little short size shadows, little patter patter of running footsteps. The attraction to toys, you know, all these little things that we've, you know, even the little voices that we've captured seem to come from a child. And the interactions that we've been having, if they are interactions, it all just seems to point to it being a child, a very young, youthful sort of person. So we're just sort of going with that. And I mean, we didn't know anything about Patty or this child, or that there was even a child there. We were just sort of going, I mean, our gadgets and our trigger objects were, you know, churning out responses, and we're going with it, and that's how we go. We go with it and see where it leads us, and sometimes it leads us to a dead end, and sometimes it might take us into some more interesting territory. But we you just go with the interactions and things are happening, and where the data leads. But with the lake house, it's been interesting because it wasn't until a few years after, or maybe probably a couple of years after we started working there and doing our research, because we've been there a few years now, that we learned that when the house was in its previous location, before it was moved there, there were stories of a young child that was seen in the house, because it was used for many different things, that house. It was a very community sort of driven house, so it had many uses, but there was always stories about a child, a young girl that was seen on the stairwell and on the top mezzanine and top floor, and, you know, she was often seen in the house. We didn't know anything about that until we started getting our interactions, and we started saying, well, it seems like it's like a little girl. And it really sort of cemented it for me when we had a good friend of mine, James Gilbert, who's another person you should have on your show one day. He's lives down in Wellington. He's a paranormal investigator. He's written another book. Actually, his book Spooked was the one that inspired me to write my books. So,
right, okay.
He'd be a good one. But he joined us. He came to Auckland for a night, and he joined us on an investigation night there. And I took him to the lake house, and we did that there. And he sat at the bottom of the stairs, where often a shadow is seen coming down the stairs. And he got quite excited. He's very skeptical. He's probably more skeptical than I am. But he called me over, and he told me that he's just had this weird experience where he was sitting on the ground at the bottom of the stairs, looking up the stairs, and then he started to see the shadow coming down the stairs. And it was a very short shadow. And he thought that his eyes were just playing up, and it maybe because maybe he was just a bit tired and his eyes were playing up. But the shadow got closer and closer to him and came right up to him, to the point where he reached out to it, thinking it was going to touch him.
Hmm.
And then it disappeared. And for him to admit that, that's quite special, because James doesn't do that.
Mm.
So that was very interesting for me. That was a good moment, because here's James, a rational, grounded, skeptically minded person, experiencing something that other people have experienced without really knowing the full backstory. And even he, at the end of it all, said, you know, I think there could be some little child there, because it's almost like she's playing with us and running around and doing this and coming up and down the stairs and playing up for the, you know, playing up for people. It does feel like that, you know, and I was quite surprised to hear a skeptic saying that. So, yeah, it's an interesting place. So we're going to keep going, but we've got unlimited access to the place. We've got the keys. We can go anytime. I sleep there from time to time. I'll just, at the end of a horrible week at work, I'll just go and spend the night at the lake house, and I'll sleep on an air mattress, and it's just so peaceful and quiet. And it's just interesting the sort of sounds you hear.
Yeah.
It's lovely. It's good therapy.
Yeah.
Spending a night with the ghosts.
Yeah, that's taking mindfulness to a new level, Mark.
It does. It's very relaxing.
Well, listen, as always, my friend, thank you so much for fitting me in. And as we work through our time zone differences, as always, you're very accommodating to fit me in, my friend. So what's next? Have you and the team got another vigil planned somewhere else? Is there a new location that you and the guys are going to go to?
Yeah, we've got a few places lined up. We've got a couple of new ones which are quite exciting, which we're looking forward to. Sort of down South Way, we've got not South Island, but down South Auckland, a couple of locations there that which have been offered to us. And it's quite good, because the more we get known, as people sort of hear about our work and what we do and our reputation, which has always been nice and clean, people approach us these days, which is really nice. We don't have to struggle about finding locations and being rejected, because there was a time right at the beginning where we were just being rejected by everybody. Yeah. Nobody would let us in. And these days people are inviting us in, which is really nice. So it's a lot easier. So we're taking advantage of all that and going where the stories are, of course. And so we've got a new few places, and I'm working on a new book, which will be out. It'll be The Haunted North Island, and that'll be out next year. This year I'm concentrating on an album. I've got a musical project that I've been doing for 40 years. It's our 40th anniversary this year.
Yeah.
It's a dark experimental industrial thing that I've been doing since 1985. So, it's our 40th year anniversary. So we've, got an album coming out, and I'm going to be doing a performance night, for that sometime at the end of the year. So I'm concentrating on that this year. But we're also slotting in a few weekends away and a few team investigations here and there as well. So, yeah, busy, keeping active and enjoying life, as they say, and just filling every moment with stuff.
Ah, excellent. And that's how it should be. That's how it should be, Mark. So where can everybody find your books, Mark? Follow your channel and keep up to date with everything you and the team's got going on, sir.
Well, we're just Paranormal New Zealand or Paranormal NZ, which is on Facebook. We've got a YouTube channel. Our old name was Haunted Auckland, but we changed it to Paranormal New Zealand because we sort of grew out of Auckland and we sort of were covering more area and more distance. So we changed our name to Paranormal New Zealand about a year or two ago.
Mm.
So, yeah, so basically it's just hauntedauckland.com. We've kept the same website name. So it's hauntedauckland.com. And Paranormal New Zealand on YouTube and Facebook.
Fabulous.
Or just Google my name and you'll find it. I'm everywhere.
Well, I'll put links to everything as always in the show notes. And once again, always lovely to speak with you, Mark. Always enjoy listening to you and hearing about your adventures down there, my man. And I look forward to the next book. I wish you all the best with the musical performance later this year. And keep in touch, and all the best to you and the team, my friend.
Thanks very much, Paul. Always great to talk to you. Stay in touch, man.